Yes, I did forget the, is it Valentine's Day? Yes. Treats? Oh my God, it's so delicious. come and get your sugar fix on. And now I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker, Greg. Come on down, Greg. Thank you, sir.
I got some notes here. That's mainly to keep me from going on a tangent in the wrong direction. My name is Greg, and I know you're probably not going to believe this, but I am an alcoholic. Congratulations to the token takers, and welcome to all the new people in this room. I was told early on in my sobriety by a temporary sponsor that I was so screwed up that it was going to take rooms full of people to help me. And this is one of those rooms. So welcome to the herd. Start off with my story. My drinking career started when I was about 14 years old. I had a paper route, and somehow, not sure how, I got a hold of a bottle of rum. Yo-ho. And didn't know what to do with that bottle of rum. So a friend of mine says, well, come over to my house. And conveniently, my parents were heading off to a party that day or that evening. So I got on my bicycle and rode 5 or 6 miles over to my friend's house with a bottle of rum stashed in the back. And I don't remember a whole lot after that. I do recall opening the bottle of rum and pouring some in a cup, and him being somewhat of a normie, apparently, took a drink of it and went, whoa, that's nasty. I don't want any more of that. I took a drink of it, and I went, wow, that is nasty. Give me some more. Like I said, I have no idea how I got home. I got no idea what happened. The next thing I remember is my mom waking me up at like 4 o'clock in the morning to do my paper route with a hangover, with her driving me. What a pleasant trip that was. Riding around with my mom on my paper route at 4 o'clock in the morning with a hangover. Sure, it was my mom that did it because my dad would have been way too mad. And, you know, my parents were not alcoholics. My parents barely drank. I said they went to a party, but they come home sober, which is completely ridiculous. But big part of that is because when I was 6 years old, my dad was hit by a drunk driver and almost killed. He lost his leg. He was in the hospital, in and out of the hospital for at least 3 to 4 months, and then he was in bad shape for quite a while. He was a surveyor when that happened. It happened on his way home from work, and he wasn't able to still be a surveyor after that, and I got at a young age to see what kind of destruction alcohol can bring to a family, because it completely changed everything. Everything changed in a minute. And, you know, from then on, we lived a different lifestyle. He was on disability. We didn't have a lot of money. And you would think that would keep me from drinking and driving. Did not. But I do remember when I was a little kid spending many, many nights laying in bed thinking, when I grow up, I'm going to make that guy pay. He's going to pay. And for many, many years, that thought went through my head. thank God that that never happened, and I got over that. But you know, I just knew alcoholics were those guys that were homeless out on the street. That's what an alcoholic was. I had no idea the true definition of alcoholism or what alcoholics were. And, you know, when I started drinking at 14 years old, that was just the beginning. And that was a launching pad because it gave me the illusion that, you know, that I was in control. And it brought so many things to me. It brought me friends. It brought me popularity. It brought me just so many things. After I got a car when I was 16, that opened up all kinds of new opportunities to drink. I resisted doing other drugs because that lecture that my mom had given me of the evils of marijuana and how if I tried it, I was going to get addicted to that, and that was going to lead to this, and it was going to lead to that. And so I resisted. A lot of my friends were smoking pot and doing drugs and mostly pills back then. But I resisted for several years. And then I finally got talked into it with peer pressure into trying some marijuana. And that was wonderful. And I realized, you know what? My mom was lying to me this whole damn time. So I was off and running. And, you know, there was always an excuse. I had quite a number of friends in the area. I grew up in La Mesa. I was born in Grossmont Hospital. And I had a lot of friends in the area. I was pretty fortunate when I went into high school at Helix High School that I was able to have it pretty easy because I had two older sisters that went through Helix, and they were very popular. And they knew a lot of people, and a lot of those people kind of guarded me and made it really easy for me. But having those older friends made it to where I could access alcohol a lot easier. And there was several liquor stores that we could buy at from the time I was, you know, 17. And we would just go and just party out and go to one of the guys' houses and spend the night, call my mom, yeah, well, we're going over to Jeff's for a pizza party. And they believed it, probably. But, you know, I got to the point to where I couldn't stop drinking. And it crossed that line. I got married when I was fairly young. We were together for 17 years and married for 11. That was pretty much my bottom. I've had a number of people, old farts in this program go, you were a pretty high bottom drunk or high bottom. You had a high bottom. And I say, well, yes and no. I didn't lose my house. I didn't lose my car. I didn't wreck any cars. I was pretty good at drinking. I'm pretty good at drinking and driving. But, you know, when you get to the point to where you want to kill yourself, that's as low as I care to go. That's pretty low as far as I'm concerned. And you go through those phases of wanting to die and then wanting to kill yourself. And then the next phase is planning on how you're going to kill yourself. I was a little history. I was in the mountain rescue team for 31 years. So I did search and rescue for a long time. And in that time, you would think that search and rescue is going out looking for people and bringing them home. It's also responding to plane crashes and child abductions and, unfortunately, suicides. So there's a lot of people that want to go out in the mountains, park their car, walk off in the mountains, and kill themselves. And through those 31 years, I put a lot of people in body bags. And I saw the final... the finality of what suicide does. And I was, you know, for a long time, I would put myself in that person's shoes and try and see why they did what they did. And I saw a lot of different ways of killing yourself. So when I got to that point and I was thinking about that, I could go through those in my mind, going, yeah, no, I don't want to do that one. That was really messy. No, I don't want to do that. Well, that one doesn't look too bad. And so going through that whole process puts you in a whole different mind frame. And I know my friend Dell, what was it, Baker? Baker? He looks over at me before the meeting starts and he's all, it's Baker. So I figured I'd get that in. We're even considering driving our car off the same bridge after talking about that for a while. And I had pretty much pushed everybody out of my life. I pushed all my friends. I pushed all my family. I pushed all my my work colleagues out of my life. And it was a pretty lonely place. And the only person that was left in my life was my ex-wife. And then she left. And that was my bottom. That was when I decided, okay, this is it. I don't want to do this anymore. And, you know, I had gone through quitting drinking. Over and over and over, I couldn't figure out why I couldn't quit. For a number of years, I decided, okay, I'm going to quit for a month every year. I'm going to quit for a whole month and prove to myself that I was not an alcoholic, because alcoholics can't do that. And I was able to do it. I could go for a whole month, and then at the end of that month, yeah! And go after it and miss work. But I was miserable still. And so it got so bad that I finally went, okay, I'm going to quit for more than a month. I'm just going to quit. And I actually was able to quit cold turkey by myself, no program, for 2 years. And near the end of that 2 years, I was more miserable than I ever was. Because I still had that thinking. I still had those actions and reactions that us alcoholics have that we need to change. I needed to change everything when I came in here. I needed to change my friends. I needed to change my work situation. There was a lot of things I had to change, but the biggest thing I had to change was me and my attitude. And through working those steps is what did that. So when I first came in, I came in to get my ex-wife back. I didn't come in to get sober. I didn't come in to become a sober member of society. I came in to get my ex-wife back. And soon after that, I found out that was not going to happen. And that's when I started planning out you know, how I was going to kill myself. But fortunately, there was quite a number of really, really key people in my early sobriety that helped me with that and helped me through that transitional period. And I remember sitting in the back of a meeting and looking at the steps, and I'm going, yeah, I could do that one. Yeah, I could probably do that one. And then I saw God, and God, God. I'm going, oh, no, this is a religious trap. Now they're going to have me going to church, and I'm going to be going to, you know, church at two or three times a week, and I can't do this. And it just slammed the door shut right then. And I realized that I never saw that part that's underlined over there that says, as we understood them. So I was getting ready to leave a meeting one night, and I was just not doing good. And this guy approached me and said, what's going on? Let's talk. And I said, I got a real problem with God and religion and all that stuff. And he said, well, what is your problem with it? And I went into, you know, my problems with early religion and what I had seen and what I didn't like. And he said, do me a favor. Go home and write down a God that you could deal with. You, not their God or their God. Write down a description of a God that you could believe in and that you could deal with. Okay, I could do that. So I went home and started writing. And I wrote and wrote and wrote and rewrote it. I wanted to make sure it was perfect because I wanted to get an A. So I went back with my full sheet all rewritten and went to hand it to the guy. And he says, I don't need to see that. That can be your God. And that just threw those doors open. It was that simple. And for somebody as stubborn as I am, to be able to throw those doors open took that one very, very key person. And I was so very fortunate to have so many of those key people in my early sobriety. Because without that, I would not be here, I promise you. So I really started looking at those steps, and I'm going, yeah, there's still a whole bunch of God stuff. You know what? I can rewrite that. I can make that different so that other people that have the same God problems that I do can get sober. So we can do away with that one and not do that one, and I'll rewrite that one. And I had it all figured out until I really sat down with a sponsor and started going through the steps. But before I did that, I started working on myself. So I started making amends right off the bat. You know what? I'm going to go out and make these amends. I know what I need to do. I'm going to go tell this person, and I'm going to go, you know, talk to these people. And I ran that by somebody, fortunately. And he's all, whoa, sport, slow down. Chill out a little bit. Those steps are done in order for a reason. You have to start at step one and create that foundation. You have to start at the beginning and not skip through the steps. You have to do them in order, and there's a reason, and you will understand that reason when you work them, when you work through those steps with a sponsor. All right. So trying to find a sponsor, that was a whole different adventure, let's say. My very first sponsor was a guy that I knew ever since I was, I don't know, 10 years old. He was a next door neighbor's relative. And I knew him when I was a little kid. I'm all, huh, that'd be a good guy to be my sponsor. So I went and asked him to be my sponsor, and he's all, I guess. Well, started working with him and found out that he had some really strange ideas about how to work the steps and how to, it didn't match what was I was reading in the book. And he had some really, really big biases and some issues. And I went, you know what? I'm going to find somebody else. And fortunately, I did. I went through a couple other temporary sponsors until I found the sponsor that I could actually sit down and respect and do some really good, serious work with. And that's really what it takes. Take somebody you can really trust, somebody you can tell anything to, and you got to really find somebody that has your same values, which does not necessarily mean the same political values or the same, because I've worked with a lot of guys that are just way on the other side of the fence for me as far as politics. And that's usually what I say is I start out by saying, we're not going to bring any politics into this. Politics stay completely out of AA. And if you have a problem with a politician or whatever, and that comes out in you doing your steps, that's okay. I'm not going to comment on it. I'm not going to say yes or no, or we're not going to agree or disagree on politics. It has nothing to do with it. And that is not going to happen. And set those boundaries right off the bat. And that has worked for quite a few different guys. So when I finally was able to find a God that I could deal with, and it's a nature-based God, so I find my God in nature. My dad was turned us on to nature when we were little kids. We went camping all the time. He was into animals and really into nature, and that's where I found my God. And I could not necessarily connect directly with that God myself. I couldn't pray directly to that God in my mind at that time. So I had to create a spirit guide between us, and I prayed to that spirit guide, tell God that I'll do this, and thank God for that. And until I was finally able to grasp that concept. And the very, very first time, I was very, like I said, stubborn. I'm not that way now. don't ask my wife that question though. But I was having a really hard time because I didn't know how to pray. And my sponsor at the time said, you know what, get on your knees and pray. Even though you don't believe it, do it anyways. And fake it until you make it, kind of thing. So I was able to do that for quite a while before I finally was able to truly make that connection with the God of my understanding. But I was not going to get on my knees. I'm not doing it. I can pray from up here. I can pray from sitting down. I'm not getting on my knees. I'm not going to do it. So, I don't know, I think it was about 6 months into my sobriety, We went to the May Day Madness campground or camp out, and we were sitting around at the campfire until really late. I mean, it was 1 o'clock or something in the morning. Everybody bailed out. I was sitting at the campfire all by myself, and I just hung out there for a little while and was just on an incredibly pink cloud. And I got up and I wandered back to my tent trailer, walked inside my tent trailer and thought, you know what? Nobody can see me. I'm going to get on my knees and pray. And what I was praying for, like I said, I was in Mountain Rescue for about 5 years before that, and I was thinking that I might be doing that for the wrong reasons, and maybe I should quit that and start focusing more on my work, on my sobriety. And so I actually, in my tent trailer, at almost 2 o'clock in the morning, everybody else is sleeping, got on my knees and prayed to God to give me a sign if I should keep doing Mountain Rescue and search for people and bring them home. And got done, got up, sat down at the little dining room table in my tent trailer. 10 minutes later, I hear a knock on my door. I'm sitting there going, oh, one of my friends must have forgot something or need to borrow something or whatever. I open the door, and there's a lady standing there, tears running down her face. She says, I'm lost. Can you help me find my way home? I get choked up every time I say that. But I didn't at that second see that as a sign. I went, oh, sure, yeah, okay. Jumped up, got out, got my jacket on, walked her way over to the other end of the campground, found her place, came back, walked over, sat down, and all of a sudden it hit me. Oh, my God, that was my sign. That was amazing. And I've had those. Was that important, Michael? No? So I've had quite a number of those burning bushes happen to me in my sobriety, and it's made it to where I really have a real good belief and connection with the God under my understanding. And the God of my understanding has changed through the years quite a bit. It's morphed. And so one of the things that I a lot of times talk about in meetings is creating a safety net. So when we get in this program, you're told that you need to go to meetings, you need to work the steps, you need to get a sponsor. But it's more than that. That's the beginning. That's the start. Because once you get sober, doesn't mean everything's going to go perfectly. Rainbows and unicorns. Things are going to go wrong. And shit's going to hit the fan. And you need to create that safety net before that happens. You know, when it hits the fan is not the time to start creating your safety net. And that safety net is creating friendships and fellowship within the program. That's going to dinner with people before or after meetings, going to breakfast getting involved with other people in this program, getting phone numbers, not just going to meetings and doing the steps. I know people that have done that. I know people that still do that. I know a guy that's got 35 years of sobriety that doesn't have a God, and he goes to one meeting a week and white knuckles it as far as I'm concerned, and he's still sober. It definitely can be done, but it's a whole lot more comfortable, and it's a whole lot better way of life if you create that safety net. And you know, I've gone through quite a few things in sobriety. On October 26th, 2003, I got called out to do evacuations for a fire that started in Ramona. And so 2 o'clock in the morning, I got jumped out of bed, got all my rescue gear, and deployed and started waking people up and ahead of the Cedar Fire. And we started up in towards Ramona, got moved back pretty quickly. You know, and one of the things was I got up that morning, I drove up over the hill. I lived down in the canyon, and I drove up over the hill, and I could see yellow flame or orange flame from one end to the other of the horizon. And I knew that, you know, that this is the biggest fire I've ever seen. And the wind was blowing directly in my face. And I thought, you know what, this could be coming to my house. I live in a rural area. And so when I got to the command center, I said, okay, I'll do what I can. But when it gets to a certain point, if it's heading towards my house, I'm going to bail out. So I worked the fire for, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 hours. I don't even remember. I was pretty exhausted by that point. Got into Blossom Valley, evacuating people. It started getting crazy because the fire was just right behind us. There were horses running around in the streets. There were propane bottles exploding, car tires exploding. I said, you know what, if it reaches Highway 8, I'm bailing out and heading home to try and save my home. And we made a stand at Highway 8. There were probably 50 fire trucks there. And I said, okay, if it jumps the highway, if they're not able to stop it right here, I'm heading home. I was in contact with my wife, told her to take my 3-year-old son, our dog, and get out of there. You know, grab a few things, go to my mom's house where it's safe so I don't have to worry about you. So she did that. I got to the point to where the fire was coming up, and it didn't just jump the freeway from here to here. It jumped the freeway from here to at the top of the mountain, just like that. And I went, oh my God, I gotta go. So I bailed out and I headed home. And I lived down in Harbison Canyon. And the fire raged through there. It was something I'll never forget, watching that fire with those winds come across, I mean, so fast. And it came up to my back gate, and me and my next door neighbor fought it off at our back gate. We got it done, high fives, thought we were all good. Turned around and looked, and it had come back around up the canyon and caught the house right next to me, big A-frame house right next to me, on fire. Nothing we could do about that. That house was 10 feet away from my house and lit my house right up. And I tell you what, after being up since 2 o'clock in the morning, this is, you know, almost evening time. It was pitch black because of all the smoke, but I was completely spent and exhausted. and I ran back into my house to try and save a few things. As it was burning, I couldn't get into either one of the bedrooms. I closed the bedroom doors because they were already on fire. That's where all of our paperwork and pictures and all that stuff was, and wasn't able to get in there. But I was able to grab a few things. It's funny in a situation like that what you grab. My brand new Bose speakers that I just bought. I'm running out the back door and the flames so I can see starting. I grabbed our vacuum cleaner that we had just bought, $200, and ran outside. And all I could do is walk outside and sit there and watch my house burn down with everything I owned in it. I had lived there for, I don't know, 20 years at that time. You collect a lot of stuff in 20 years. And a lot of memories, a lot of things that I wish I would have gotten out of that house. And I was sitting there on the wall. I had a video camera. I actually videotaped it. I think I've only watched that videotape one time since then. And I'm sitting on the wall. I have no water left. I had not had water for hours. And the water out of the hose was nasty. It was I don't know if it was the bottom of the tank or what it was, but it was brown. It was ugly, and I was not drinking that. And my next-door neighbor looks over the fence. He's all, "You all right?" I'm all, "Yeah, as good as I can be, I guess." He says, "Anything I can get you?" I said, "I could really use something to drink." A couple minutes later, I see an ice-cold six-pack of Budweiser coming over the fence. There you go. If ever I was going to drink an ice-cold Budweiser after being sober, that would have been the time. But I said, "No, I need water. I just need water. Thank you very much. I don't drink." And, it's times like those where you have to have that safety net in place. Because through that whole process of trying to just survive on a day-to-day basis was probably 90% people from AA that helped me through that, that helped us through that. And we had created that network of friends and fellowship in these rooms that allowed us to get through that. It was a trying time. Michelle knows that because her mom and sister have gone through the Palisades fire. They're going through that stuff right now. And it's tough. It's really tough. But creating that fellowship is what allowed us to walk through that. I mentioned the herd earlier, and I'm sure a lot of you have heard that. If you haven't, you're gonna stick with the herd, get in the herd. That came from a friend of ours, Larry Dixon, who was a very, very good AA speaker. He was great. He actually helped us rebuild our house, and he toured around speaking at different venues in AA, and one of the biggest things he talked about was that he was at home one day watching a National Geographic special, and they talked about in this National Geographic special this baby elephant that moved away from the herd and left out of the herd at just the wrong time because there were a couple of young lions right outside where the herd was. And the lions pounced on this baby elephant and were trying to kill it. But because they're young animals, they were not able to. They didn't know how to kill the elephant. So they chewed him up pretty bad, but he was able to get away. And he was able to get back to the herd. And Larry said, you know, that's a lot like us alcoholics. We're kind of the same way. This is our herd. And you go outside the herd and you get your ass kicked. And you can come back to the herd, and the herd will gather around you and protect you and help you. And it's a really good analogy for how AA works, you know? And, you know, for a long time, stick with the herd was a saying that's going around AA. And like I said, if you haven't heard it, you probably will. But I was really fortunate when Larry passed away. He had a massive heart attack, and he passed away years ago. And a friend of a friend called me up, actually called my wife up, and said, "You know anybody that could draw a little emblem with elephants for a sticker to put on people's windows, a memorial sticker for his funeral?" And my wife said, "Well, Greg's an artist, he can do it." And I went, "Okay, I'll draw this little emblem." So I do pencil drawings, and I drew this little emblem with elephants in a circle and an AA thing and his sobriety date. And passed it off to her, and, "Oh, that's great." Well, a couple of days later, she goes, "We had a better idea. How about you draw a whole herd of elephants with a little baby elephant in it, and we'll put it on T-shirts, and we'll put it on some, you know, paper, and we'll sell those to make money for his funeral expenses and for his wife." Oh, my God. Okay. I've got, I don't know, I had a week or something before his funeral. I was really busy doing really important Greg things at that time. And those drawings take me, you know, 10, 15 hours. And I'm just going, "Oh, how am I going to have time to do this? I guess I'll try." So we were going to my Sunday morning meeting. And this is another one of those burning bush things. Going to the Sunday morning meeting that we always go to. And I arrived at the Sunday morning meeting, and as soon as I got there, my stomach started hurting. And it kept getting worse and worse. And I'm going, "God, I'm food poisoning or something?" And I went, "You know what, I can't go into the meeting. I'm just going to have to go home." And so I told my wife, who I was meeting there, I said, "I'm just going home." So I headed home, got all the way home, and as soon as I got home, I felt better. Oh, damn. I walked in the house, turned on the television, that National Geographic special was on with the elephants. I was able to take a picture with older camera. Because we didn't have cell phones back then. I was able to take a picture of it, and that's what I drew this picture from, which we actually put on coffee mugs and put on, you know, anything, T-shirts and all that stuff. And we were able to pay a lot of the burial expenses and funeral expenses with that. So, I mean, that was just another one of those burning bush things that made me believe in God even stronger. And, you know, the view from inside the herd is a whole lot better than the view from the outside. It's a whole lot different. So for all the newcomers that are here, welcome. Congratulations to the guys that took tokens. Those are big deals. Every single year, that's a big deal. And but to the new guys that are here, get in the herd. No, don't just come to a couple meetings. Don't just do step work and then think you're done. Get in the herd, and it'll change your life. Sponsorship and working with others, that's another level of AA. You know, when you work steps with a sponsor, that's life-changing. But when you work them with a sponsee, that's a whole different level. That's a whole, you're working the steps right along with them and at a different perspective. So you gain different things out of doing it from that perspective, and you understand different things. Strongly encourage people that once they have gone through the steps once or twice, to start sponsoring people, work with others. That's what this program is all about. That's what this program was built on. This program was built on working with other alcoholics, one alcoholic working with another alcoholic. And when the program first started, you know, doctors, psychologists didn't really know what to do with alcoholics. And the big breakthrough came when they put all those things together. Working, one alcoholic working with the other, figuring out how and why these different things were not working. So psychologists and psychiatrists who have never had a drinking problem were trying to fix people with drinking problems. And that doesn't necessarily work. And once we were able to start relating one alcoholic to another, yeah, I lived that. I was there. And you're able to relay that to another alcoholic. It's a whole different level, and it's amazing, amazing thing. You know, I've worked with a number of people in this program, and not just as a sponsor, but as friends going to other meetings, you know, and we'll call each other, we'll text each other, we'll, whenever we're going through something hard, or something great, we'll text back and forth. And I need your advice on this. I need to run this by you. And I remember a couple years ago, one of the guys, I wasn't sponsoring him, but he called me and he's all, "She just broke up with me." And I went, "Oh, crap." I know exactly what that feels like. I was there. I had been there. And I said, "Let's go to dinner." Even though I just ate. "Let's go to dinner." "Okay, I'll come pick you up." And so I picked him up, and we talked at dinner. And I was able to relay some of those things that I went through and how I got through them. And we had just a few months before that gone through a step study together. And I knew that he had done the steps. I knew that he'd done it. And I said, "You know what? This is what you've been training for. This is why you went through those steps and why you've made these connections. This is why you called me. This is why you have my phone number in your phone. This is what you've been training for." And he was able to get through that, along with help from a lot of other people in a lot of other situations. You know, when I first came in here, I was not one of those people that could just do the AA program and stay sober. I had to have a psychiatrist and a psychologist and a voodoo doctor and anybody that would listen. And like I said, rooms full of people to help me. There were just some amazing, amazing people that were dumped in my life right at the right time. I would be in a horrible depression. I walked into my doctor's office and said, you know what, I can't sleep. This divorce thing is driving me insane. I can't sleep. I can barely work. And he gave me some sleeping pills. And I'm going, oh, crap. Should I be taking sleeping pills? And I talked to one person. They said, no, throw them away. And I talked to another person and said, well, if you take them the way the doctor prescribes them, and don't take any more than that, give them to somebody else and have them give you one if you have that issue. But I went to the pharmacy to go get this prescription filled, and I walked up to the desk, and I looked up, and the head pharmacist there was a guy that I knew from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, should I be taking this? And he's all, I'll be back in a minute. And he grabbed me and walked down the aisle, and we sat there and talked for 10 minutes about Alcoholics Anonymous and how to do things like that. And those things happened over and over and over. You know, I would be in a really bad spot walking down the aisle in the grocery store, and boom, there's somebody. When I went to make my amends, you know what? I was never going to make amends to my ex-wife. She lived in Texas by then. I had no idea where she lived, no idea at all. Her sister-in-law was in the hospital. I went to visit her sister-in-law. Boom, there she was. And it was a God thing. And I was able to make that amends. And worked through some pretty heavy stuff that I was never going to do. I was one of those things, I'm not doing that one. And, you know, once I quit Mountain Rescue, that was, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I had gotten involved with working with wolves up in Julian. And couple people here work with wolves with me. We've been doing it, 13 years now. And I realized that alcoholics and wolves have a lot in common. And working through those. So to finish off, I wrote down a few things that wolves and alcoholics have in common. Tell me if this sounds like any alcoholics you know. They can love you unconditionally or hate you with a passion, and that could change in an instant. They're social animals, but their wants and needs can uncontrollably pull them away from their pack. Whether in packs or as a lone wolf, they are always on a quest to feed their needs. Contrary to popular belief, they're afraid of everything. Every individual has a distinctly different personality that can alter with the situation. Within a single pack, there can be lovers, loners, leaders, followers, caregivers, the bold, the timid, and the intolerable. They can tolerate you one day and want to chew your ass up the next. Sound like any alcoholics you know? When they're sad, tired, or hurt, they put their tail between their legs and hide. When they're happy or feeling aggressive, they howl and make it known. They communicate with other animals through nonverbal facial expressions and body posturing. They can consume a lot in one sitting. Mating can be a mind-boggling, enduring quest for what they think or want they need. They can hold a grudge for a lifetime or like you again if you give them a treat. And finally, if you take away their shit, they will bite you. I want to thank all the people that I know and have known for many years that came to see me tonight. I appreciate you guys making the journey, but I appreciate everybody in this room. Thank you very much.
Let's give Greg another round of applause. That was fantastic. Let's thank the cooks for a wonderful chicken fried steak dinner and the Women's Auxiliary for another fantastic dinner. And we can now circle up and do the prayer of Greg's choice. Thank you.